based off of what you tip them. Is that true?
No.
Okay.
So they're paid a decent wage, because tipping is only like recommended 10%.
Okay.
So it's like a
tithe.
All right, everybody, you're back. I feel like we were just doing this. If I had to change my shirt, I think, yeah.
That's a good intro.
Oh, man. Actually, let me do this real quick so I don't forget, because I will forget. Record. Okay. So let me pray for us again, and then we'll get started. Father, thank you so much for this time together and just looking at all the evidence for the things that you've done for us and how we can share that with others so that they can have a right relationship with you. Father, we thank you for all your blessings upon us, and we pray that our lives would be a light for you, and that our actions and our words and our everything in our life would glorify you. So we praise and thank you for this time together. In Yeshua's name, amen. So in case you weren't here last night, you missed everything. I mean, no, there's a recording somewhere, so you can talk to Pastor Bob, and I'm sure he can get it to you. A lot of you were wanting the slides, and so if you go to buildersofisrael.com here and you look at this apologetics and evangelism slides, this yellow button here, and you click on that, you will be able to get the slides for our whole presentation. And then if you sign up and as for a login, and then you have to put your email down here so I know it's actually one of you signing up, since we have a security wall there so people can't go and see videos and stuff of me online, at least, without us knowing who they are. So if you sign up for as a login and then you just email me, I'll approve you, and then you can go, and we have a lot more training on the website. So, you know, this is like a very abbreviated version of these 2 evenings together of our full curriculum. We have about 36 videos. It's about 25 hours, I think, of training online, something like that. And also, just briefly, if you're interested in Jewish evangelism at all, or just understanding the Jewish people, which we're actually going to talk about tonight a little bit at the end, my father and I wrote a book called Returning the Favor, An Ambassador's Guide to the Jewish People. So that's available on Amazon if you'd like. You can check that out. And I have a book, I have a chapter in there on tactics, a chapter in there on God's existence, a chapter in there on the history of Judaism, things like that. So if you're interested at all in understanding the Jewish people better, it's kind of a one-stop shop there. And there's lots of book recommendations in there as well. So you could check that out. But yeah, but the slides are on buildersofisrael.net. That's .net. There's also a link here to Jew and Gentile Radio. So my name is David Halevi, and I'm the founder and director of Builders of Israel, which is a gospel ministry in Israel to Israelis, the Jewish people, and Gentiles as well. And we do just that. We share the gospel with Jewish people, with Arabs, with Druze, with really anybody we come in contact with. But also we train other people to do the same, just like Aaron Marshall does with his ministry at Ratio Christi. And when he gets up, he's going to here in a second, he's going to introduce that as well, in case you weren't here last night. So I'm a Jewish American. Actually, I'm actually a Jewish Texan. I was actually born in the Promised Land, which is Lubbock, Texas, if you didn't know that. I'm not a Texas Tech fan, so there you go. Anyway, and then my family and I immigrated to Israel last year. And, of course, we are followers of Jesus of Nazareth, so we're Jewish believers. So that's what we do. And then Aaron and I started a podcast about six years ago, in our seventh year now, where we discuss theology, apologetics, evangelism. We have guests on. We had lots of different people on to discuss lots of different topics. Sometimes we agree with them. Sometimes we don't. And then we discuss our disagreements. And sometimes we just discuss disagreements that we have with ourselves. So literally like myself talking to myself that I disagree with myself. So anyway, I'm going to hand it over to – is that about everything? I'm really not the greatest at intros or exits. So
that's about as good as you're going
to get. All right, that's as good as it's going to get. Okay.
Yeah, the I think just a couple things. What's that? Oh, for the video. Just a couple things. My name's Aaron Marshall. We moved to Utah 2019, and now we do ministry. Yes. Oh, this is the super secret recording. So let me try that again. Hey, my name is Aaron Marshall. Well, my jokes cater because my kids are like in that perfect range. So like I just kill with my kids. Actually, now their kids are getting older. Now most of them think I'm terrible. But it's the same five jokes I've always used.
Aaron is a master at Simon Says. Like he will take anybody down at Simon Says.
We can play later if you want. You know that sounds. A little bit about us. So we, you know, in 2019 moved to Utah, or went to Utah really for a year, almost as a sabbatical, living in North Carolina, and never thought we'd be there ever. And now we're there for the rest of our lives. And this came up, someone was asking, so Ratio Christi is on about 150 campuses nationwide. So David is the director and founder of Builders of Israel. I'm not a director or a founder of Ratio Christi. I'm just the guy that has a Ratio Christi chapter in Utah at Utah Valley University. We helped to get started a chapter at the University of Utah and pass it off to somebody else. And so we started the chapter at University of North Carolina, Wilmington, passed it off. And so we run a chapter of the ministry, but if you go on our website, so down below, just a couple of things from our ministry. These booklets here, we have one, Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? Does God Exist? All of those are available for free download on our website. That's our national website. So I do think they make you sign up for, like, give your email and you'll get some, recurring emails from Corey Miller or something. But no, that is national. So if you get information from them or requests from them to support, that's support nationally. If you want to support me or you want to support David, that's through our specific, missionary numbers through the ministry. So, yeah, Ratio Christi broadly on about 150 campuses nationwide, but I run the chapter at Utah Valley University, and hopefully by God's grace, we will start, we've started meeting just as a Bible study, but we will have our church officially plant September of next year. So that's our prayer, and so we're hoping to get some of our funding in place in order to do that. And so, we are praying for some monthly donors. I think both of us are. One of the reasons David's here for this month is to try to raise some support, because it's very hard for him to raise support in Israel. So we're praying that we can help, that we can get him to full support so that he can stay in the land, because that's obviously super important to be able to do the work that he's doing. So just 2 seconds, 2 minutes on a recap from last night. So if you weren't here last night, I really do hope that you would go back and watch that or hear, however that's, access that. Actually, if you listen, I think we've done a couple episodes. We've done an episode, I think, on each of these topics on our podcast. So go back and listen to that, because we would say that is the philosophy of how we have these conversations. Here's kind of the meat of the kinds of things we talk about tonight. So we started talking about, the first thing we talked about last night was just the nature of truth, that when the claims of Christianity are objective truth claims about reality that are either true or false, that what they're not is just my own personal opinion. So as believers, we have to stop relativizing our faith and trying to, for me, Christianity is true. But these are the kinds of claims that are either true for everybody or they're true for no one. And so we have to understand, we have to make sure that we're conveying that to people when we talk with them. And if they're on the same side, if they're willing to go where truth leads, then obviously we would say we're on the same team, so to speak, facing truth wherever that takes us. We believe that takes us to the biblical Jesus. And then we introduce tactics in this conversation. So what we found is Greg Kokel's book, Tactics, the only book that we require students to read when they come to Utah is Tactics, because that's everything. So if we can teach you how to have conversations, we can talk about the content. And again, it's good, so if you're coming to Utah, it's good to read a bunch of books on Mormonism, but it's even better just to meet somebody and ask them what they believe, right? Because most of the students we talk to do not believe the same things like historic Mormonism believes. So just ask people, what do you believe? And you'll get an education. And so then we talked about the categories. Thirdly, we're trying to find out where people are and then trying to have conversations that are appropriate to them. And so, all of this, obviously, we're giving you sort of like, this is like from man's perspective, obviously from God's perspective, God's doing whatever God's doing. And so, when we're doing, we always go in pairs. When we're doing evangelism, someone's talking, someone's praying. And we're praying that obviously the Holy Spirit's opening their eyes. We're praying that God's moving in their hearts. I mean, we're praying for all of these things to happen, but we're also, these are the best ways that we found to kind of get those conversations started. And we're just kind of, prying to see, is this someone that the Holy Spirit's moving in their heart, right? Is this someone that is, they're kind of, their eyes are open and they're aware of what's going on. They're wanting to have these conversations. And so that's where we found to be the kind of the philosophy of how we have these conversations. And so what we'll talk about tonight is what are the main things that we want to talk about. I'll introduce this, and then we'll go back, and I want to show you that that video. So we talked, I introduced this a little bit last night, but you know, we would talk about the nature of truth. Again, if people can agree, great, we agree there's truth and the opposite of truth is false. Then we would say the main topics we want to focus on is, does God exist? We're not going to talk about this tonight, but if God exists, miracles are possible. I mean, it's kind of get thrown in for free. So, you know, people say, what's the greatest miracle in the Bible? What do you think the greatest miracle in the Bible is? Anyone? Bueller. What's that? Yeah, okay, salvation, the resurrection. You know, we would say Genesis 1:1. You know, it's like, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If he creates everything out of nothing, raising somebody from the dead, not that hard. You know, creating everything out of nothing. So, you know, if God exists, miracles are possible, and miracles can be used to confirm messages from God. And so then we can look at the reliability of the New Testament, which we'll talk about tonight. Do we have what the authors wrote? And then is what they wrote true? Most importantly, was there a guy named Jesus who actually claimed to be God, said, I'm going to prove it in my death and resurrection, then actually did that? And, you know, I would argue, we'll talk about that tonight, I could argue, I think I could, you know, win a case if I, you know, if the case and before a jury was, did Jesus rise from the dead? I think the evidence would be compelling that we can convince a jury that he rose from the dead, if they're willing to look at the evidence, and if they're willing to be not biased, like we talked about last night. So that's where we're going tonight, and then we're going to talk a little bit at the last session. David's going to share something that we think is really important theologically, that's really important for us, but we also recognize that maybe some of you disagree. That's where the categories are really helpful, because maybe you disagree, ask questions, right? Let's talk about it. Let's have those conversations, and let's do that well. So this is a video. This is a guy, Stephen Fry, who was a British actor. Maybe, I think he was in Downton Abbey, so maybe many of you know him. But how would you respond? It's funny, the interviewer makes some pretty hilarious facial expressions in this, but how would you respond if you were talking to somebody and they said these kinds of things as an atheist? And they muted. No, they didn't say anything.
This happened yesterday. It was working. And then... Sorry, y'all.
You should have been expecting this, I think.
Technology is not our for, you know, we're not best at that.
Settings, output, yeah. Okay, let's try this again.
Suppose what Oscar believed in as he died, in spite of your protestations, suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God.
You hear that?
What will Stephen Fry say to him, her? Or it?
I will basically, what's known as theodicy, I think, I'll say bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I'd say.
You think you're going to get in on that?
No, but I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was Pluto, Hades, and if it was the 12 Greek gods, then I would have more truck with it, because the Greeks were... They didn't pretend not to be human in their appetites and in their capriciousness and in their unreasonableness. They didn't present themselves as being all-seeing, all-wise, all-kind, all-beneficent. Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac. Utter maniac. Totally selfish. Totally. We have to spend our life on our knees thanking him? What kind of God would do that? Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind. They eat outwards from the eyes. Why? Why did you do that to us? You could easily have made a creation in which that didn't exist. It is simply not acceptable. So, you know, atheism is not just about not believing there's a God, but on the assumption that there is one, what kind of God is he? It's perfectly apparent that he is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever. The moment you banish him, your life becomes simpler, purer, cleaner, more worth living in.
All right. Let's take, so one of the things we asked you to do last night, so two, you know, maybe in twos or threes or 50s, you know, whatever you want to do, but you know, twos or threes, how would you respond to that? You know, so Stephen, you're in a conversation with someone who says something like that. How would you respond? Maybe what questions would you ask? What are your initial thoughts? So we're just going to, you know, take 2 or 3 minutes. We're going to break up if you can, talk with somebody, and then we'll come back and see if we can help you maybe answer those. Ready? Go. Because, you know, like if it's YouTube, you can turn the volume up on the
right,
thing
the
and on the...
It may have just been the volume that I recorded it when I ripped it off. You know what I mean?
And it could be so it's different for the video. So like, we should turn this up. Can you...
From back there.
Yeah. We'll ask him what's in there. Maybe for the next one, maybe I can show like that Joe Rogan video. I could just say... I could tell him. I could just tell them, here's the Mormon view. Take 2 minutes. It's like they, you know, they have that one cuss word. You know, I can just say, take, you know, it's basically the same difference. Did you already solve all the problems? Just like, yeah. You guys are good. Yeah. All right. I know that's probably plenty of time to solve the problem of does God exist, right? I'm sure I give you extra time, you know, just for filler. No, I mean, these are hard questions, right? And the things that he's bringing up, thinking about stuff we talked about yesterday, what do you think, category-wise, what level do you think Stephen Fry is? Probably level one, right? Yeah, negative one. Yeah, and that's so. But you have to be aware of that. I mean, we've talked. You know, I'm on the college campus, and someone comes up to me with that attitude. I'm probably going to just have a 2 minute conversation with them, share something that I can. You know, try to put a stone in their shoe. You know, metaphorically, and you know, probably move on. And again, we're not like, you know, I mean, obviously we're praying that, you know, that their heart would change, but if they're not open to that conversation, then, you know, that we've got to be aware of that. So what we want to do, and again, this is the introduction, obviously, to a big, much bigger conversation, but we want to just try to give you two different arguments for God's existence. One's a little bit more philosophical, the one that I'll tackle, and then one's a little bit more of a traditional argument, the moral argument that David will talk about here in a second. And basically, we're just introducing you to how would I go about trying to talk to people about God's existence? How would I try to demonstrate that God exists? Now, many, you think, well, I don't, you know, why do I need to demonstrate God's existence, right? I'll just go to the Bible. That's the whole point, is they don't believe that God exists. They don't believe the Bible. So just talking to them about the Bible, they don't believe that the Bible is the Word of God because they don't even believe God exists. So in order to have that conversation, it seems like going back to our 12-point argument, we first want to show them that God exists. And if we can't move past that, it really doesn't matter if we can show them some of these other things. So that's why we would say we have to first start with God's existence. Now, there's tons of good arguments for God's existence. There's a book that I have on my shelf. It's, you know, it's 20 different good arguments for God's existence. And there's tons of, you know, books that you know, on this. And so, again, hopefully just kind of just whets your appetite for these kind of conversations. But there's a guy named Josh Rasmussen. He's a philosopher out in California. And he wrote a book called How Reason Can Lead to God. And it's just a book that I've just really thought was just fascinating. And it's kind of the argument that I like to kind of talk to people. It's just kind of, if I have one argument, because it kind of hits on a lot of different things that I kind of present to people. Now, again, good arguments aren't going to persuade everybody, right? I think it's a good and sound argument, but just because it's a good and sound argument doesn't mean it persuades everybody. So I present the information. If they're interested in talking about it, awesome. If they, you know, if they don't, then maybe we try a different argument. Maybe what David's going to talk about, the moral law argument, which is a really good, we think is a really good argument. And so you're just trying different things, trying to meet the person where they are. Last semester, I was at UVU, Utah Valley University. We had our table set up. We had a question on there. And the question was just, does God exist? Or I think, no, the question was, is there good evidence that God exists? Yes, no, maybe. And then we always put like, don't care. I put like, I don't respond to polls. I put that on there just to see if someone responds. And then I tell them that's responding to a poll, you know, just kind of trying to like lighten it up a little bit. But this guy came up to me, and you could tell he was a little, at first I thought he was a little bit more of a level one Stephen Fry, very sort of antagonistic, a little bit more confrontational, basically tell me there's no good arguments for God's existence. But over the course of about a 45-minute discussion, I found out he wasn't a level one. He was probably closer to a 3 or a 4, and we had a really good conversation, and I shared with him this argument for God's existence. And then after that, he invited me on his podcast, and the podcast was called something like In the Search of Sky Daddy or something, like, you know, super sort of, yeah, just like, you know, like kind of arrogant. And but when I started talking about this argument on his podcast, and he said I hoped you wouldn't bring this up because I've been thinking about this and I didn't really know what to do with it. I said, well, maybe it's because it's true, because God exists. And so we're still in conversation now, and hoping that obviously that, you know, we can persuade, that I can persuade him, or, you know, the Holy Spirit can show him that God exists, and then we can, you know, move that conversation along. So Josh Rasmussen, he says this. He says, think, it's kind of a thought experiment. Some of these arguments for God's existence are thought experiments. Take everything that exists. All right, so take everything that exists, okay? Now, whatever that means everything. So if you believe in multiverse, if you believe in whatever you think includes everything, put a line around it, okay? We call that the blob of everything, okay? Now, there is nothing outside the blob of everything. Do you see that? I mean, again, hypothetically, right? You see there's nothing outside the blob of everything. So what you could never do is say something outside the blob of everything cause the blob of everything, because then it would be in the blob of everything. Does that make sense? So the blob includes everything that exists. Now, what do we know about some of the, at least some of the things that are in the blob of everything? They are what we call dependent things. Dependent things are things that rely on something else for their existence. So the chair, this podium, this computer, you know, car, whatever, Lydia, right? All, like, they rely on other things for their existence. But here's the question. Remember, the blob of everything is everything, and it's full of dependent things. But how do we account for the blob if it's full of only dependent things? Because remember, the blob itself can't be dependent, because there can't be anything outside the blob that it could depend on. Does that make sense? So the blob has to have something, or someone, we would say, at a foundational level that has an independent, self-sufficient, and what we call a necessary nature. In other words, it has to exist. It's not dependent on anything else. It's self-sufficient, and it itself has to be able to cause all the things in the blob of everything that exists, because remember, nothing outside the blob could cause that. It's the sort of thing that must exist. Therefore, we would also say it has to be eternal. So now you've got, again, blob of everything, the foundational layer, whatever, you know, if you're thinking about that, of this blob of everything has to be something, someone, that is independent, self-sufficient, necessary, and eternal. The other thing this foundation has to have or be is all-powerful. Why? Because it can't get its power from outside of itself, right? Because again, there's nothing outside of it. So everything that's happening in the blob of everything has to have its power from the foundation, which means the foundation must be all-powerful. This power itself must be eternal. The power can't have come to existence because something outside of it would have to have caused that power to come into existence. So think about this, and again, there's way more in the book, but now what you've got is a independent, self-sufficient, necessary, eternal, all-powerful foundation for everything that exists. But then he says, is that as far as we can go? Now, if that's only place we can go, what does that remind you of? These are exactly the characteristics that we know is God. But we can say even more than that. Because he says, what's one thing in the blob? You are, right? One thing in the blob is you. Now, what kind of thing are you? First of all, you're a dependent thing. So again, there has to be an explanation for your existence. But what are four characteristics of human beings that have to be accounted for? And he goes through, and again, in each chapter, he kind of talks about this. One of the things that you have is a mind. An immaterial mind. The question is, can physical particles produce immaterial minds? But can physical particles produce independent minds? He calls it a construction problem. Those don't seem like the kinds of things, physical particles, that can produce independent, immaterial minds. Because our minds are not material. Now, what's interesting, if you're a materialist atheist, you do not believe in an immaterial mind. People like Dawkins and Hitchens and atheists that are materialists, they think that at your base level, that all you are is a brain. They actually deny that the mind exists. I think that's impossible to even, I think the clear evidence is that minds exist. And again, immaterial minds that can access reality, like what we're doing right now. Complex. You are complex. What does that mean? What we know, we were talking about this with somebody last night. When Darwin was writing Origin of the Species, they thought that the cell was just this blob of stuff. What we know now, this is with the entire intelligent design community, what we know now is that the cell, at the heart of the cell is DNA, and at the heart of DNA is basically a really, really, really complex computer processing system. In fact, Bill Gates says DNA is computer software only way, way, way more complex than anything we've designed. Now, does anybody, when you look at the information that is on these slides, do you think that these slides came about by time plus chance and material particles dancing on themselves? No, you think they came from a mind, right? In a similar way, we understand that DNA, if you are basically information, and information comes from a mind, it seems like that at the foundational level, we have to have something in the blob of everything that it can account for the information that's in you, that can account for the immaterial mind that's in you. What about moral agents? So we'll talk about this again as David presents the moral argument. What best describes the moral landscape that exists, that we're a part of, and our experience of it? What best describes that? It seems like the foundational level is going to have to be some kind of moral foundation, that it can account for the fact that we know certain things are right, certain things are wrong. And then lastly, rational. You are a rational being. Have you ever thought about this? This is kind of the nerdy things that I think about at night, which, tells you a lot about me and pray for my wife. Where does reason come from? Where does reason come from? Could reason, think about even right now, y'all are rationally, hopefully, maybe some of you are checked out, right, asleep, but some of you are rationally trying to think through the stuff that I'm talking about right now. Where does that ability, that process come from? Could it come from non-reason? Could you ever have non-reason that leads to reason? It seems like, no, you have to have it in order to have creatures that are thinking rationally. Now, there are other things that that are included in the foundation of everything. I think like abstract truths like the laws of logic or math. How do we account for them? Could a physical process or a physical being the foundation for everything, could they account for these things? It doesn't seem like that's the case. So because of the kind of being that you are, it seems like it points to, again, the foundation for everything, and we talk about this blob of everything, at the bottom of all reality, there is a rational, mind-like being with a moral nature. Now, if we start diving deeper into systematic theology and stuff, we could say maybe that we're not talking about a specific being, but just talking about the foundation for everything is going to have to, in some way, be rational, mind-like, and moral. But you couple that with what we've already discovered, so rational, mind-like, moral, all-powerful, independent, self-sufficient, necessary, eternal. These are exactly what we talk about when we talk about God. So the question we have to ask Stephen Fry, we have to ask our atheist friends is, whatever worldview you have has to explain all the data. So David's going to talk about this in a minute with the moral argument. The question is, can atheism, materialistic atheism, explain all the data? Can materialistic atheism explain the fact that you exist with an immaterial mind, that you're basically information, you have a moral compass, there's the moral landscape in which we live in, and that you're rational beings? Could atheism, materialistic atheism, or atheism itself explain that? It seems like the answer is no. Our worldview has to be coherent, and it can't contain contradictions. It has to be able to explain all the data. So it seems like at the base of all of everything that exists, it has to be something, or we'd say someone, who has those characteristics. We'd also say it has to be perfect. It couldn't have any imperfections in it, because it couldn't possibly be improved, because something outside of the blob of everything would have to improve it itself. And there's way more we could say about that. But if this argument is true, and again, this is sort of just an entry into a conversation with somebody, something that you can ask, someone you're talking to, your atheist friend, you could just kind of bring up these facts, and you could say, look, if these things are true, then just by pure reason, we've arrived at the greatest possible treasure, the self-sufficient, eternally powerful, supremely rational, and perfectly good Creator God, which is exactly what we find when we open the Bible to Genesis 1:1. And we've demonstrated that God exists, that God exists. Now, the question is, one of the things that people will say when we look at arguments for God's existence is, that doesn't prove Christianity. But that was never what the arguments were designed to do. The argument for God's existence just shows us that the universe in which we live in is the kind of universe that has to have God, that must have God at the foundation of everything. It can't not have God because of these characteristics of the universe that require the foundation to have those characteristics, which we know is what we're talking about as God. Now, some of these are also, can be helpful in our conversations with people from other religions. For example, my Mormon friends, when I'm talking to Mormons, I will give that argument for God's existence and, we can talk about that. But on their view, God, again, was once a man who became God. Their God is an embodied being who, is about 6 foot tall and lives on this planet, Kolob. But he was a material, they're basically materialists. So if you the Doctrines and Covenants, it says that even spirit is really, really refined matter. So all of the arguments against materialistic atheism actually apply to our Mormon friends. And so there's another great argument for God's existence called the Kalam cosmological argument. And it simply says that every effect has a cause. The universe came into existence. That means the universe is an effect. Therefore, the universe had to have a cause. And the cause of that had to be outside of it. And we can give evidence for why we would say, both philosophically and scientifically, we'd say that's the case. But one of the implications that we can draw from this argument, this is actually from Einstein's theory of general relativity, we learn that time, space, and matter are co-relative, which means you can't have one without the other, and that time, space, and matter came into existence. And we can demonstrate that philosophically and scientifically. Now, why does that help us? Because that means that if that argument holds, then the cause of the Big Bang, and again, that is, we don't have to get into old Earth, young Earth, whatever, that there was nothing, and then bang, there was everything. There was something that came into existence. The cause itself could not be embodied in time. It could not be material. It had to be timeless and spaceless and immaterial. But if that's true, then Mormonism is refuted. So these arguments can both demonstrate to atheists, if they're willing to listen, that there has to be an argument, there has to be a creator. Aquinas' arguments, which some of you are studying through Geisler, if his arguments hold up, they are demonstrations for God's existence. They're not inference the best explanation. If we say that we're talking about inference the best explanation for some of these, if Aquinas' arguments are right, they're demonstrations God has to exist. And I think they're right. I think he's true. So like my friend Frank Turek says, he says, I'm more convinced that God exists than I am that Christianity is true, and obviously I'm convinced that Christianity is true. Because you couldn't even be having this conversation if God didn't exist, if he wasn't the foundation for everything. And so we can also have this conversation with our Mormon friends or friends that believe in different religions to try to help them understand the kind of attributes this God must have. And so I think that's a great argument. I think it's helpful. Now, for some of you, you're like, maybe that's a little more philosophical. So if that's the case, then we think that another really good argument for God's existence is the argument for morality, and David's going to share that with us.
You know, Paul is known for many, many things, but I think one thing that he's not really revered as, but what he is a first-rate philosopher. And so, just kind of piggyback on what Aaron was just going over. In Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. So that what's so amazing about the philosophical argument that we have, multiple philosophical arguments, is that before we had the Bible, before we had the written word of God, which we can go to and it reveals to us perfectly what creation was, is, and will be, God created us with a mind that can perceive everything about him, including his character and divine nature, apart from his special revelation, okay, which is what Aaron has just gone over. There's not a moment in time that I do not remember knowing about the Shoah, which is the Holocaust, okay? As a Jewish family, it's just always been part of our vernacular, right? We just always knew about it. I don't remember when it was that somebody set me down and told me about the Holocaust. I don't remember. It's just always been something that I've known about. When I was 10 years old, there was a woman in my hometown named Helene Shriver. And Helene was a survivor of Dachau. And when she was about 13, I believe, she was from Bulgaria. And her grandfather or great-grandfather, I can't remember, I think it was her great-grandfather, had a 100th birthday party. And as they were having the party, she said they had literally 100 relatives, and they were very wealthy. They were some of the wealthiest people in Bulgaria. She had her own horses. She had her own stable. She had private coaches. She had everything basically lived like a princess, you know. And so she vividly remembers they're all getting ready to sit down and have the celebration. And Nazis came onto their property. They came into the home. She remembers that her baby brother was being held by one of their servants, and immediately Nazis came in and shot up the nurse, shot up the baby, and just began killing everyone who was old or young that was there. They then carted everyone off that was able to Dachau, which was a work camp, but obviously many, many people, hundreds of thousands, died at Dachau. And as a 13-year-old child, she should have been murdered because she said she really wasn't old enough to be of any use in the work camp. But because for whatever reason, the Nazi doctor who was there, not Mengele but someone else, I forget his name, chose her to be part of physical experiments. And so then they took her, and she would periodically have surgery performed on her without anesthesia, and then they would monitor what happened to her. And she showed me scars on her legs and scars on her hands where they removed bones, removed tissue, sewed her back up, saw what the function was. This is how she lived. And somehow, by God's grace, she survived. Okay? this is the reality of one of the most terrible atrocities in human history, right? Recently, my son, before he went into the Israeli Defense Forces, we took a trip to Poland, and we visited Auschwitz. So Auschwitz was a death camp. 80% of the people who arrived at Auschwitz were immediately murdered at Auschwitz-Birkenau II. This, what you're looking at, is the only surviving gas chamber. This is Auschwitz II. It's a different site than Birkenau. They're a few kilometers apart. So Jews were brought here before the other gas chambers were built, and they were made to undress outside. And in the yard outside, they were no more than 150 yards from the commander of the entire death camp. And so his kids were playing out in the front yard as Jews undressed and then were marched into this gas chamber to be murdered. So you undressed between 400 and 600 at a time. You were marched downstairs into this room, and then they dropped Zyklon B pellets from the ceiling, and you suffocated from the inside. These are scratches on the walls as high as you can reach your hand from people and their last grasps at life. You then had local Polish non-Jews who were enslaved to carry the dead bodies out and then into the adjacent room, which was the crematorium. They soon realized that there weren't enough crematoriums to possibly burn all the bodies that they were killing daily, so they started burning them in open pits. So that as new Jews arrived from all over Europe, mostly hungry, going by train to Auschwitz, and they arrived, they could smell burning hair 24/7 as human bodies were continually burned for years and years. About 1.2 million Jews were murdered in Auschwitz. So I think as we think back to our video with Stephen Fry, one question, you know, it's unquestionable that Stephen, although he rails against this God that he doesn't believe in, but, you know, also hates, right? What is one thing that he is absolutely certain of? That evil is in the world, right? And so what he's doing is he's importing a moral value and duty, right? He is absolutely certain that there's evil in the world, that killing people is wrong, that, you know, cancer in kids is wrong, and just this world that allegedly God created is terrible, right? But the question is, where does he get that from? What is this innate knowledge that he has of what is right and wrong, right? And so the ultimate question is, you know, I think if I'm talking to Stephen Fry, if we're having a conversation, and I just tell him my story about Helene Schreiber, and I tell him my story about visiting Auschwitz and the realities of the Holocaust, what is he going to say? He's going to say, that was terrible. That's why God doesn't exist, because things like that happen. That was completely evil. I totally agree with you. It should never happen. It's evil. It's humans and what we are capable of. It's completely evil. But then the question is, if we compare Hitler and Mother Teresa, right, regardless of what you think about her theology, okay, she was a Catholic nun, right? I think universally everyone recognizes that Mother Teresa did great things. Like, she was a quote, good person, right? And Hitler did terrible things. He was a very bad person. But again, how do we know that? How do we know that it's not just Hitler's opinion versus Mother Teresa's opinion? How do we make that judgment? When pretty much universally, just regardless of your background, unless you're an insane person, if someone says that Hitler was not wrong in the Holocaust, then you just stop talking to that person, okay? You just don't talk to them anymore. That's not a conversation. Again, if somebody said -1, maybe they're -5, okay? So let's, you know, a little less emotional example here. Here's two maps. Now, one of these is the actual map of Scotland. But how do we know which is the actual map of Scotland? How would we know this? At this moment, can you tell which is the real map of Scotland? Maybe if you're from Scotland, you know, and you know, driven around the coast a million times, and you know this, you know, third crook from the right is really the right bay and the other one's not the right bay or whatever. But I couldn't tell you, you know, right? So how do we know which is the actual map of Scotland? Because what do we have? The real unchanging Scotland to measure that we can go to as the objective standard. And then we know that, okay, it's actually map B. Map B is the actual real unchanging Scotland, right? So here, we don't know, like, which is the real unchanging moral good that we're comparing Hitler to or Mother Teresa to, right? Because here we have a real unchanging map of Scotland to compare, which is the real unchanging map of Scotland, right? How many times did I say that? Anybody know? Okay. C.S. Lewis was, you know, wrote Mere Christianity. Of course, there's theological things that we disagree with him about, but amazing author. And he said, as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. So this is Stephen Fry, right? This is basically what Stephen Fry was saying. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? And man does not call a crooked line, unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing the universe with when I called it unjust? So, in other words, we know what a straight piece of lumber looks like because we've all seen a warped piece of lumber. We know what a straight road looks like in Texas because maybe we've been to Louisiana and we know what crooked roads look like, right? another example is you can have sunshine without shadows, but without sunshine, there would be no shadows. So what is this sunshine we're talking about? What is this straight line we're talking about? You know, I was actually a cabinet and furniture maker for almost 20 years. So I'm literally a Jewish carpenter. I think that's where the similarities probably end. Okay. But all my clients knew when something wasn't right, right? I mean, even in their mind, you know, of course, I never made a mistake, but I tried to. So in other words, we know when something's off. Why? Because we're comparing it to something else that we know isn't off. Okay? So, who is this ultimate objective standard of good that we're constantly comparing things to intuitively? Because if there is no God, the Nazis were not wrong. It's just Hitler's opinion versus Mother Teresa's opinion. It's just the Nazi Party's opinion against the United States, you know, government's opinion. Love is no better than rape. Who are you? How are you to say? Who are you to say that rape is wrong? Why would that? Wouldn't that just be that just molecules in motion against other molecules in motion that somehow don't want those molecules in? It doesn't add up.
In fact, there was a paper that was published a couple years ago by these. These evolutionary biologists who in the paper was about the evolutionary advantages to rape. And on their worldview, they would be right. But we all know that they're wrong, right? But I mean, these are the implications of that worldview.
Yeah. Ergo, there are no human rights, right? Religious crusades are not wrong. Tolerance is no better than intolerance. Can't complain about the problem of evil, including natural evil, which Stephen Fry was complaining about, which I'll talk about here in a second, because there is no objective standard to measure anything against. And so God is not just the best dude in the room, okay? He is in essence good, okay? He's not just the smartest guy in the room. He is in essence knowledge. He isn't just the most fair guy, just guy in the room. He is in essence just. Okay? And so these are really important things to know in how we think about God. Again, I don't think how we think about God is the most important thing that you can think about. Okay? And so what we're not saying, very important, that atheists can't be moral. They can. Stephen Fry can do moral things. Okay? Atheists don't know morality. Obviously, Stephen Fry knows morality, right? He's railing against things that he thinks are immoral. Atheists can't justify morality. Okay, this is what we are saying. Knowing what's right does not explain why the standard of rightness exists. Just because you know it, it doesn't mean you can explain it. You can know what's in a book and deny there is an author, but there would be no book to know unless there was an author. So we know what is good because we have a lawgiver who is God, who is the ultimate standard of the law of good, the essence of good itself. An atheist, can know what's right and deny God, but there would be no right without God. And so, one of the things that happened after the Holocaust was, I think ultimately there was only maybe 24 Nazi war criminals convicted at the Nuremberg trials, and they may have only hanged about 12 out of really thousands who oversaw death camps, factories that killed many, many, many. Unfortunately, we ended up bringing some of those Nazi scientists here, like Wannar von Braun, who ran a what I would call a death factory, the V2 rocket factory, where they would hang the slowest five Jews at the end of every day. So you would look up and you would see five new people that were murdered every single day because they were the slowest workers. Okay, this is who we're dealing with. But the Nazi defense was, we were just doing what we were told. This was the law. How can you come into our country and tell us what's right and wrong when, by law, we can murder Jews? That's what we decided was legal. And if you have no objective standard of good, if you're from, let's say, a nation like we are in, unfortunately, today, I think, I mean, many of us, obviously, we believe in an ultimate standard of good, but many people would just say, no, there's right and wrong, and it's the government that determines what is right and wrong, okay? Well, was slavery right before we outlawed it? No, of course not, right? Of course it wasn't right. Of course it wasn't moral. And so then at that point, if that's your view, it's just American law in the 1940s against National Socialist Germany's law of the 1940s. It's just their opinion against our opinion, right? It's might, at that point, it's might makes right. And so ultimately, where Stephen Fry and many of our atheist friends go wrong, and many of our friends who maybe aren't atheists, like my friend I was talking about last night, my friend Ralph, who is the Israeli tour guide, we had this conversation where he is angry at God and doesn't believe in God because of the Holocaust, because his family died in the Holocaust. So he's in the same predicament as Stephen Fry, right? He almost, I would argue with my conversation with him, wants there to be a God. He wants there that existence to be there. My father-in-law, he says he's a hopeful agnostic. He wants there to be a God, but then he rails against religion, okay? So, again, ultimately here, God himself, in his essence, who is good, is the ultimate standard. And without him, there is no moral obligation for anything. Good does not exist. Evil does not exist. I can come and stab Moshe in the face right now, and there's nothing that anyone should do about it if God does not exist, because there is no right and wrong.
Or just they would just say, "I don't prefer that. You know, right. I don't prefer you stab me in the face." But that's about the most you can say. To finish the story about the Nuremberg trials, they were the prosecutors were like, "Well, they're right. It was legal." But then they said, "Wait a minute. There's a law above the law. There's a law. It doesn't matter if what they said was legal. It's wrong objectively for all people, at all times, at all places, like we talked about yesterday. So we can prosecute them for war crimes because what they did was wrong. It doesn't matter if it's legal." We would say this, maybe for many of you, hopefully, would say it's the same thing with laws that are allowing abortions today. It doesn't matter that it's legal. It's objectively wrong. In fact, if you read Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail, which is a great thing to read, go read that. His whole point of what he was doing in pushing back against the Jim Crow laws in the South, he was saying, some of you are saying that we're just trying to uproot all of law and we're just anarchists. He says, not by no means. He said, there are certain laws that are right and there are certain laws that are wrong. And the laws that are wrong are the laws that don't correspond to the eternal law of God, and we have a duty to push back against those laws. And those laws were wrong, even though it was legal, it was wrong, and he said we have a duty to push back, and we would say he's right. In a similar way, the only way that makes sense is if there's an eternal standard, right? And we'd say that is God. And I think that's why, now, maybe just one last thing. With this argument, so if Stephen Fry came in and he's talking, or let's say this way, I was one of the students that we were talking to this week, and she was telling us about a lot of harm a lot of religious trauma that happened to her, and now she's an atheist. Probably she's not interested right then on this, you know, in this objective moral law argument. She needs a pastor. She needs someone just to love her. You know, she needs a hug more than she needs an argument. And so we're saying the argument is true, But some, most people, especially we talked about yesterday, most people's doubt is emotional doubt. It's not necessarily logical doubt. And so they've been wounded and they've been hurt. And so they need, you know, they need someone to come along and love them. And we can love them by, you know, sharing with them the true gospel. But when they, if they have those questions, we can show them that not only is the problem of evil not a good argument to prove atheism, it's actually one of the better arguments for God's existence. And we can help them to see that the logical case for God's existence is actually, you know, the logic, you know, shows that, yes, what happened to them was evil. In fact, we stand with them to say that it was evil, but it's because God exists that we can say that. So we need to, so sometimes we have to make, you have to be careful where some people, you know, they're not interested in, they don't need a logical argument, right? They need pastoral care, and some people need a logical argument. So this again is where the questions come in to try to figure out where that person is.
Yeah, exactly. And one more thing before we do it, we'll have a 5-minute break here. I want to cover is the topic of natural evil. And so something that Stephen Fry, when he brings up the argument of bone cancer in children or this parasite that blinds children or, you know, all the other things, he's talking about something we categorize as natural evil, okay? Earthquakes, you know, tsunamis that kill people, what about these things? And so he's begging the question by assuming that God created a world that we live in now. But God didn't create the world that we live in now. God created a perfect existence for humanity to thrive in, and we ruined it, okay? And so all of those things that we experience now because of the fall of mankind, like when I go out to work in the field and there's thorns and thistles and all these things that Adam had to struggle with, right? Now we struggle with different things, but these are the minor things as far as the fall is concerned. He's begging the question, and so he's assuming that something is the case about the beginning of all things when that wasn't the case. That isn't the world that God created. God did not create a world where parasites ate the eyes out of children or that the children got bone cancer and all these other things, okay? So, again, that's another, you know, just something I wanted to cover real quick in regards to natural evil. So let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll be right back here again.
Because Dawkins is an atheist. They didn't need-